from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Like many other institutions of higher learning, the University of Louisville plans to return to in-person classes this fall. Like the rest of the world, it's been a year of adjustment for U of L students, faculty, and staff because of coronavirus. Meanwhile, the university's health system has taken a leading role in coronavirus research and vaccine distribution. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll talk about the past year and the future with U of L President Dr. Neely Bendapudi. And we'll discuss initiatives the school is launching in response to calls for racial justice in Louisville and across the country. We welcome your questions and comments, and we'll start the show by checking in with State House reporter Ryland Barton on the wrap-up of the Kentucky General Assembly. It's all ahead this hour on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Later in the show, we're going to talk with Dr. Neely Bendapudi, the president of the University of Louisville. The last time she was on the program was late summer of 2019. And of course, a number of things have transpired since then, including a world pandemic. She'll be with us in the last two segments of the show, and we welcome your questions and comments for Dr. Bendapudi. Give us a call, 502-814-TALK. 502-814-8255. You can send a tweet if you'd like. And our handle is WFPL News, and you can reach out through us to us or through Facebook. But first, the 2021 Kentucky General Assembly is in the books, the second session with a Democratic governor and a Republican supermajority in both the House and Senate. And here to bring us up to date on what happened, what didn't happen, and what's still up in the air is Ryland Barton, Kentucky Public Radio State House reporter. Ryland, welcome back.
Good morning, Rick.
Well, going into the session, Republicans who control the legislature said they would take action to give them more of a say in emergencies such as the coronavirus pandemic. Some said the governor had overstepped when he put COVID-19 restrictions into place, like mask wearing, crowd size limitations, and that sort of thing. As promised, such legislation was passed. The governor vetoed it. Lawmakers overrode the veto. Bashir has filed a lawsuit, and the judge temporarily blocked the law from taking effect. Where does that stand now? What's going to happen next?
Yeah, it's still in court. It's in Franklin Circuit Court, and we're awaiting a judge's ruling there to see if he... right now, parts of the laws are blocked. Basically, the most controversial parts that would have set an expiration date of 30 days for the governor's executive orders, also allowed businesses and schools to stay open during the state of emergency no matter what, as long as they followed CDC guidelines. So those parts have been blocked, but we're still awaiting a final ruling on that. And I think we can also probably expect that this issue will likely be appealed to the Kentucky Supreme Court. Just because it's important. I think there's a lot of people who want to know, to what extent, what do the governor's powers look like during the state of emergency? It was certainly a state of emergency that nobody had experienced before, longer than anybody had experienced. And at least for Republican lawmakers, that raised a lot of questions as to whether, the governor should have such broad authority. So these laws are trying to limit some of that broad authority, but we've yet to see whether the courts agree that the state constitution doesn't provide him that authority.
So we've got the Republican dominated legislature, super majorities. We've got a Democratic governor. So we've had this back and forth this year in the General Assembly. There was the session, and then there was a veto period where the governor vetoed many of the bills passed by the Republicans. They came back for a couple of days, overrode those vetoes, and today's the last day for the governor to do any more vetoes after those 2 days that the legislature was in session, right?
Right, and we just got a veto, a Senate Bill 48, which dealt with open records laws. It would have protected some or shielded some public officials like police officers, judges, prosecutors, even public defenders. It's actually a very long list of government officials. It would allow them to shield request that personal information like addresses, email addresses, phone numbers, birth dates would be redacted from state records and unavailable to open records requests. So Governor Beshear vetoed that, and the legislature won't have a chance to override that. Still awaiting word on Senate Bill 5, which is the law that allows businesses or provides legal protections to businesses that stay open or provides legal protections to businesses during the pandemic. This is actually something that was proposed by Senate Majority, then Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at the federal level. But kind of a mini version here in Kentucky. I'm sure there are plenty of other bills that are kind of waiting in the wings that aren't coming to me right now. But yeah, the session is just about finally over. There's no more after today. There aren't going to be any more opportunities to override vetoes or veto legislation. And granted, they don't have any opportunity to override vetoes. They lost that last week when the legislature officially ended on Tuesday.
Right. And we have seen the hand of Senator McConnell in this session as the Republicans spent their political capital. And one of the things that stood out was this bill that right now the governor, if a senator leaves his post, U.S. senator, the governor picks a successor, and it can be someone from the governor's own party if it's opposite, even if it's opposite of what the senator was.
Right.
But now that has to be the same person, has to be from the same party as the person who left, right?
Right. It sounds so confusing, yeah. But basically right now, if a senator dies or resigns midterm, the Kentucky governor gets to appoint a replacement to fill out the rest of that term. So the legislature has changed that law now. The governor can still pick the replacement, but it's got to be from a list of three people selected by the party of that departing senator. So say if Mitch McConnell were to leave office before 2026, that's the end of his term, then the governor would have to pick from that list of three people, at least temporarily, he would have to pick from a list of three Republicans to temporarily fill that vacancy. So it's a big change in how Kentucky law works. And really, you know, a lot of states are, states are kind of split as to whether they allow, have a special election, say, or allow the governor to appoint. But Kentucky will be moving over to the column of states that, at least limits what the governor's appointment power does there.
And McConnell has just won election to his seventh term. Okay. There's no indication that he's going to be leaving early, but now that law exists,
right?
And it does.
And he said that he actually, he initially said that he supported the legislation, and then later, later in the legislative session, said that it was actually his idea, that he had asked Senate President Robert Stivers to carry this bill. This is just one of many pieces of legislation that really just kind of it changes and limits and weakens the Kentucky governor's power. It's just, and there are just several bills that do that in many ways, including those ones limiting his power during the states of emergency.
There were a number of high-profile education bills that were passed and vetoed and then overridden, and I guess the big one is the education opportunity accounts. For those who don't know, what is that?
Yeah, it's this broad school choice bill, and the education opportunity accounts, it's these scholarship accounts where people can donate money and get tax refunds for donating to these accounts, and students would then be able to use those accounts for private school tuition in the state's largest counties. I believe it's counties over 90,000, which I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe that's the nine largest counties by population in Kentucky. But it also allows those accounts to be used for public school expenses, so school supplies or tutoring or after school services in some ways. This bill ended up, in order to get it passed, there were a lot of other things that were added to it. It also allows students to or requires counties to create plans for students to be able to transfer between counties. So say if they want to go to a neighboring school district, right now it's just very difficult to do that, but this would kind of streamline that process a little bit. And also it was passed with the promise that that Kentucky would fund full day kindergarten, which it did not. But now, even though most school districts across the state have full day kindergarten, this would the school districts end up funding them using their own tax dollars. So this will fill that gap for those school districts and free up, you know, probably some money for them to spend them on other things. However, it also, the funding is only in place for 1 year. So it's kind of it's a temporary thing. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if lawmakers continue it next year, because next year is going to be another budget writing year. We're going to have three budget years in a row in Kentucky, all because, you know, the schedule got kind of gummed up by the pandemic.
We're talking with Ryland Barton on In Conversation on WFPL about the just completed Kentucky General Assembly, where there were some measures that were Beshear and the General Assembly agreed upon. And I guess one of the more prominent of those is an election bill that he has signed into law.
Yeah, so this is another big omnibus bill. And, you know, really what it does, it expands early voting, or really creates early voting. Right now, under current law, there's no excuse early voting. So this will create 3 days in which people across the state can go in person in their counties to cast ballots. It also, you know, preserves the online portal for people to request absentee ballots, which is something that was created last year during the pandemic. And the other thing it keeps from the pandemic last year is allowing counties to have drop boxes for people to drop off those ballots. It was coupled with some election security measures, one of which makes it easier for the Secretary of State to remove people from the voter rolls if they've moved out of state or have registered to vote in other states. Another one bans so-called ballot harvesting, which is something that wasn't legal in Kentucky in the first place, but just kind of strengthens language on that. But yeah, Kentucky's kind of being celebrated as this state that that expanded access to voting while a lot of other Republican-led states right now are restricting it. However, it is important to mention that Kentucky's voting laws were incredibly restrictive in the first place and still are. But this is just a step in the direction of kind of opening things up, especially compared to last year when everybody was eligible to cast ballots by mail, when there was this giant in-person voting period. It is, you know, voting is going to be starkly different from that, but it will be a little bit more expansive than it was before the pandemic.
Kentucky's getting a big chunk of federal coronavirus relief money, and there's been some agreement as to how some of those funds will be spent, but the legislature wants to limit access to some of those funds by the governor, right?
Yeah, this is a really interesting moment in this legislative session where legislators were really intent on clipping the governor's powers. They actually, largely came into agreement with how to use this money. So Kentucky's going to get about $2.4 billion from the American Relief Plan Act, which is just the federal coronavirus bill. And so far, the legislature, with Governor Beshear agreeing and kind of helping craft this, they've set aside $1.3 billion of that. And it goes to all these, most of it will go to these infrastructure projects, expanding broadband access in rural parts of the state and underserved parts of the state as well in urban areas. Also, water and wastewater projects across the state, which is, you know, this is kind of one of the most important issues in Kentucky, and especially in rural Kentucky, the difficulty of maintaining aging water lines. And then there's, you know, something like $120 million for school construction and reconstruction. So it's really just a big stimulus to, you know, kind of pump some money into Kentucky's economy, but also, you know, put that money towards, a lot of projects that have needed attention for a long time. It was something that everybody kind of agreed to. But they did also require that the governor's not allowed to do it on his own. He's got to go through the legislature if he wants to spend any more of that money.
Ryland Barton is Kentucky Public Radio State House reporter. Ryland, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
When we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Neely Bendapudi, president of the University of Louisville. You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett, and our guest for the rest of the program is Dr. Neely Bendapudi. She is the 18th president of the University of Louisville, selected by the UofL Board of Trustees in April of 2018. Dr. Bendapudi came to UofL from the University of Kansas, where she served as provost and executive vice chancellor. Dr. Bendapudi, welcome to the program. Good to have you back.
Thank you so very much. It's an honor to join you.
We welcome your questions and comments for Dr. Ben Dupuy. Call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet at WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. Again, our number, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Well, the last time you were on the show, the first time you were on the show was in August of 2019. There's been some water under the bridge since then. But let me start by asking you, I guess the big exciting news at U of L is that you have your sights firmly set on full in-person classes in the fall, right?
That's correct. We are very, very excited. We may still have some hybrid courses just because of the format, but we fully intend to be open very, very excited about it, for sure.
Now, has this been a gradual return to in-person? Has there been like a hybrid where some classes virtual and some classes not? How has that worked over the past year?
Well, as you know, one of the things that we did at our university is that we never really fully shut down because housing, dining, library services, for many of our students, we are their home and we are their best option to stay safe. So we've really been open in that sense throughout. But yes, already we are using a hybrid model where a course might meet partly online and partly on campus. And this summer, we are going to get more preparations underway so that the fall, every student who wants to be in person on campus will have a chance to do so.
So let's talk about how this is affected. I know it's affected everyone in a lot of ways, but how's the health of the university right now, given everything that's happened? How are you doing fiscally and otherwise?
The university is doing honestly as well as can be expected and even better than we could expect. But that's all because of our faculty, staff, and our students. I would like to talk about the health of our people as well. But as an institution, we're on sound financial grounds. And I'm proud to report that in fall 2020, despite everything going on, we actually had a slight increase in enrollment of our freshman class. And that's a great testament, again, to the fact that people view the university in such a positive manner. We had a record year for research, but I will also tell you that it has been, when you think about the people, it has been a huge impact in terms of the toll this has all taken, not just on physical health, but certainly the mental health that has been impacted for, candidly, all people, as you know.
Well, yeah, I've marveled over the past year at the resiliency of people and their ability to adjust. I think beforehand, if you had told us we'd had to go through all these things that we went through, it would have been hard to believe. But it's really remarkable how people have adjusted.
That's so true. That spirit of resiliency that exists here is tremendous. And I think especially of our young people who may not have had the high school year they expected, not the freshman year they expected, or their graduating year that they expected. They have truly risen, and I marvel at that. And also really the resiliency of our faculty and staff, because in about a couple of weeks, we had to just turn on a dime and have all classes moved online, and our staff had to figure out new and different ways to support our student body. So all in all, I would say that a lot was thrown at everybody, but we've risen to the occasion.
I think the last time we spoke, you were just unveiling or you're going to unveil a three-year strategic plan for the university. Of course, you had just come into the job. How has the coronavirus affected that plan, and how is that plan going otherwise?
We are sticking to the plan because there are two things, Rick, that I'm actually very pleased about. If you recall, I still recall our conversation about the strategic plan. It's online. We have metrics. We monitor how we are doing on all of those. But interestingly, as part of the strategic planning process, we went through a pretty rigorous bottom-up approach in terms of what are the big challenges that we as a university should tackle. We call them the grand challenges. And I want to share with you what those are, because they really stood the test of time. We had no idea. I know it's only a brief period, but if you think of all the the COVID-19 as well as the social unrest we've all faced calls for racial equity and justice. I think the grand challenges we identified prior to any of that show that these are the ones we as a university should be focused on. So the three areas we focused on are empowering our communities, that we as a university will figure out how do we empower communities. The second is how do we advance our health? You know, it's like a new vision for health in all its forms. How do we really advance that? And finally, how do we engineer our future economy so that it works for everybody? So those are the three grand challenges. And as I look back on a year that none of us could have predicted, I feel pretty good that the wisdom of the people at the University of Louisville identified three grand challenges that hopefully we are positioned and poised to focus on for the betterment of society.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're talking with Dr. Neely Bindaputi, president of the University of Louisville. We welcome your questions and comments. 502-814-TALK is our number, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet. WFPL News is our handle. You can reach out to us through Facebook as well. Well, you mentioned the social unrest and the introspection that many of us, many institutions are going through right now as a result of everything that happened in the wake of the police killing of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and many others. And I know you launched the Cardinal Anti-Racism Agenda. Tell us about that.
I'm glad to. To me, every university should be an anti-racist university and probably and hopefully is. What do I mean by that? Well, racism is many, many different things, as we all know. But to me, at the core of it is a deep intellectual laziness, because it's saying that I know a rather trivial fact about a person, because as you know, we share over 99.99% of the genes that we all have in common. And so racism is the idea that a person is inherently superior or inferior on some dimension just because of their race. So anti-racism then is a rather simple idea that humans might be different on many ways, but it really has nothing to do with the race of a person. And this is something, as I said, should be at the core of all educational experience, which is truly trying to understand, see nuance, and see where we have commonality. But at the University of Louisville, it really seemed to me that we needed to step up and say, we will be actively anti-racist. And if the problems didn't happen overnight, I am under no illusion that the solutions will not happen overnight. But we are trying to tackle systemic racism as well as individual attitudes and behaviors. And we have a very dedicated committee that is working on it. And the anti-racism agenda, Rick, we focus on, broadly speaking, four areas: students, faculty, staff, administration, and policies. So the idea is, let's push ourselves. If we don't set a lofty goal and say, let us be a premier metropolitan research university, which is what the General Assembly asked us to do, but let's say we can do all that and be anti-racist. Part of the reason for that particular assertion is often people think there's a false binary, that you can be either excellent or diverse. And all the research out there, after all, we're an institution of higher learning, and we want people to think critically and look at the data. And I will tell you that conclusively, we believe in inclusive excellence, because we know that if we can bring diversity of thought, diversity of life experiences throughout an institution, throughout an organization, whether it's a public entity, a private entity, a university, anything that you can think of, the results show that we end up being more successful, however you define it, and more resilient as well. So we are working, there's a group that's been hard at work. We know the broad areas we need to work on, and we're coming up with specific action steps that we will take. We have not been waiting, as you can imagine, for all of this to be done. We're taking steps to move this forward, but we are aware that there's a lot of work that needs to happen.
Let's go to the phones and the number to call if you'd like to talk to Dr. Bendapudi. If you have a question or comment, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Let's go to Michael in Louisville. Hello, Michael. Welcome to In Conversation. Dr. Bendapudi's right here.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Hello, Dr. Bendapudi. It was quite interesting hearing you talk about racism when there is now a on-campus petition that has been signed by over 750-plus African-American faculty, staff, and administrators, and they, you have yet to address their concerns of hiring practices, hostile work environment, and the lack of minorities in upper management. I'll listen to your response off the air. Thank you. Thank you again for having me.
Thank you, Michael. I'll give you a chance to respond, Dr. Bendapudi.
Certainly. And actually, thank you, Michael. This is something that I take extremely seriously. And I'd like to tell you that the people who have signed on to it know that we are actively working on this. And I can tell you some of the steps we've taken and where else we will go. I'm proud that we have set up metrics for all of these. If you go to our strategic plan, you will see that we have included metrics for recruiting minority students, their retention, their progression, their success. Similarly, we have challenged ourselves on recruitment and retention. It's not just recruiting, but retaining and promoting our faculty and staff. That's been a big emphasis for us as well. And I don't want to just make it about specific details, but I can tell you that in upper management, that has been a huge focus for me on making sure we have leadership. And I would say that if you look at the numbers, we actually stack up quite well. It doesn't mean we're done. I do know there's so much more that we need to do. But all I can say is I'm deeply committed to this and will continue to be so.
Of course, the University of Louisville has a huge footprint in our community, physical and otherwise. It is the University of Louisville. What role do you see the university taking in the months and years to come and being a part of community healing as we deal with these issues?
I think that the University of Louisville has historically played a very big role in the life of the community, as it should. We are a public university. I said at my installation that my vision of the University of Louisville is that we have ripple effects. We have to make a positive difference in the life of the city and the Commonwealth, the country, and beyond. So we can't say we're doing such a great job and not really be relevant to the life of this community. So if you look at our actions, whether it was acquiring the, at the time, as you know, Jewish Hospital, St. Mary's and Elizabeth, Peace Hospital, Fraser, all of which were on the selling block for such a long time, and there were no takers, we stepped up because we knew that this healthcare being provided, if it wasn't available, would have impacted Black and brown bodies the most. So actions there in terms of our healthcare, opening up our urgent care clinic in West Louisville, which we have announced, the fact that we are really doubling down on vaccinations. I hope you don't mind, Rick, but I would like to use this moment and just remind everybody that starting Monday, anyone over the age of 16 can show up at Cardinal Stadium, our football stadium, and get vaccinated. So I really hope people take advantage of that. So that's part of our effort. But the other part of the efforts we make is in education. Since the time I've been here, we've more than doubled the dollars that we've set aside for need-based funding for our students. And all of this is part of what universities do as conveners. So a third area that I think the university can and should play is really be part of the life of the community by providing avenues for debate, for discussion, for healing, for people to come together. This has been a most unusual time for us because of COVID-19. Usually when there are challenges and tragedies, and we naturally want to come together. Our instinct as social beings is to be with others. And so I know that this has been a difficult time, but we are committed to it. I will say, I know that people here hopefully know this, but the legacy of a Blaine Hudson, of people before, after, with our Pan-African Studies Department, the fact that if people can all go online and check this out, there's a report by Education Trust. So it's an independent organization that actually studies the top public universities in the entire country, over 101 of them. And it shows that at the University of Louisville, we're one of only two universities. That's embarrassing. Out of the top 101 universities that have more than 10% Black students. And we are one of three universities that gets an A in how we are recruiting and retaining Black and Latinx students. When I say that, there's a part of me that says so with great hesitancy. Certainly, it's something to be celebrated. People don't know that. But it's also, you've got to say, maybe we're just the best of a bad lot because there's so much more that needs to be done. And maybe one last point. Sorry if I'm a little out of breath. I was dashing off to come to this interview because I was at, just now at the bipartisan signing of the legislature with of the legislation with the governor of the West End TIF and the partnership between Simmons and Kentucky State, and with Breonna Taylor's family there, with her mom there, the signing of the no-knock warrants and so on. So these are all important ways that we can and should be pushing ourselves and bring healing to the community.
Got just about a minute or so until our next break, but I wanted to ask you about, speaking of the governor and state issues, state funding. It seems like for years, every budget cycle, there's not enough money for higher education. You're forced to increase tuition. What do you see happening with this influx of federal dollars coming in? I mean, do you expect to maybe, you know, get a piece of that?
I think all universities will, but it's actually not as large yet. We're waiting to see all of the pieces come in, but we are truly committed. It's a wonderful opportunity. The federal funds do come with the stipulation that half of it goes to the students. And again, a tribute to our team. We've been very, very proactive in making sure that our students benefit from it as quickly as possible.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with much more. Our guest is Dr. Neely Bendapudi, president of the University of Louisville. We welcome your calls, questions, and comments. 502-814-TALK is our number. 502-814-8255. Send us a tweet if you'd rather do that. WFPL News is our handle. You can reach out to us through Facebook. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Good to have you with us on this Friday. Our guest this hour is, for the last segment of the program, is Dr. Neely Bendapudi, president of the University of Louisville. And we welcome your questions and comments for Dr. Bendapudi. You can call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255, and you can send us a tweet at WFPL News. You mentioned earlier, you made reference to the UofL Health purchase of the formerly Kentucky One properties, including a Jewish hospital, what we used to call Our Lady of Peace, Saints Mary and Elizabeth, and others. 2 years down the road, what is the health, you know, fiscal and otherwise, of UofL Health and those facilities?
You know, again, we are very, very pleased that we're able to meet the mission. The main thing for us was to make sure that patients could be taken care of, that our education mission continues, that our research continues, and all of those are well on track. We have an incredible board. And so we feel very good about where we are. We knew that there would be challenges. It's a massive undertaking, as you can imagine. Honestly, hospital of that size closing in a community is something that happens, you know, once in 75 years, once in 100 years. So it was definitely a big challenge to face for us, but our people have stepped up remarkably well. And I keep thinking, you know, none of us could have foreseen it, but how fortunate for the community that during COVID-19 that we were able to keep those facilities open. And really even the research being provided, because early on when it came to testing, as you probably know, because of our research capabilities, we were doing the testing and also the, like things like wastewater testing and so on, not just for our own hospital, but for 8 other hospitals, both in Kentucky and neighboring Indiana. So those are the sort of things that I hope people see and say, well, we are very grateful, in addition to the clinical care, that we have the research capability that is assisting all of us.
Well, one of the first guests we had on when all this happened to kind of figure out what was going on, to tell us the facts that we did know, was Dr. John Klein, who was who was very reassuring in those early days from U of L Health. Back to this coronavirus vaccine drive-through effort at Cardinal Stadium. This is going to be the largest vaccine clinic in the state, isn't it?
It is, and I want to encourage people to take advantage of it. I have had the vaccination. I hope you have too.
Yes.
And it's really, I know in terms of how vaccine was available, where it was available, there were definitely hiccups for all of us across the state. But now is the opportunity. Anyone over 16, it's an easy process. If you, you can look it up online, you can call us, and there's a drive-through. We are making it as painless as possible. Walk-ups are available. Just go take advantage of it. Our hope is to vaccinate several thousand people a day. And I know that there may be concerns. Again, I'm no Dr. Klein. He is amazing. John Klein has been you know, really, as have so many others in our system, Dr. Jason Smith, everybody. We've been trying to have focused efforts. For example, in the West End, there were 2,500 people that were vaccinated. We are trying to do focused efforts, but this is the largest such site in the Commonwealth. And I cannot tell you how strongly I encourage people to get the vaccination. One thing, if I may, I was talking to someone earlier today. Even if you've had COVID-19, it now seems that we don't know how long the immunity lasts. It's actually not a very long period, and you should still take the vaccination. And in fact, there's some research now that shows that even if you've had COVID-19 and you've had some long-term lingering effects, that taking the vaccination seems to be good for that as well. So part of the reason I'm anxious about this is, as you know, the more people who have that herd immunity are vaccinated, the quicker we will be able to get back to being with our loved ones, doing the things we all enjoy, go out to eat, hang out with people. That very natural need for all of us to be around others will only be satisfied if we can take the vaccination. Sorry, one more thing. I've got to say it, because sure, just because you've had your vaccination, it doesn't mean you can stop wearing a mask or being as careful, because we still don't know everything we need to about the variants. But certainly, I can tell you that when my mom was able to get her vaccination, it was a huge sense of relief for her, and certainly for me as well.
Let's talk about, because we learned a lot during this pandemic. It did give us some good opportunities for learning some things, including online learning. I had my doubts about doing a lot of this stuff online at the start, but the system has held up pretty well. And what lessons have you learned about online learning in terms of, you know, the university and the things you've been able to do over the past year?
Glad to talk about that. We were one of the very first to say we are going to move online as soon as we saw the threats that were out there. And part of it is really the advantages we have. We have our Pfizer's only center for infectious diseases in North America is right here in the University of Louisville. So we knew that it was coming. We knew that we needed to take it seriously. And we also had the advantage that the University of Louisville has a long tradition of online instruction. So we have our Delphi Center for Teaching and Learning, and we realized that it took quite a bit for faculty. Outsiders often think, oh, it's online, it has to be so much easier, but no. The pedagogy, how will you keep students involved? Is it going to be, synchronous or asynchronous, meaning everybody signs on at the same time or at a different time? There were lots of things to learn, and we realized that we needed to provide tools, reassurance, encouragement to instructors, and they stepped up to do this. And we also realized how important the digital divide is. That's one of the big things, Rick, that was an aha for us, and we had actually candidly started working on it before, but it said how critical it is that not every student has the computer, the Wi-Fi connection, the internet capabilities to take full advantage of the online experience. Other things we've learned are that students, still, the vast majority of them, still want an in-person experience, that they feel they've missed out. And I can see that. I sometimes use this old analogy of knowing and being and doing as part of the learning that happens. And I think that some education can happen online, but throughout we have to make sure our nursing students, our dental students, our medical students, our arts students, our music students could also have some face-to-face or non-traditional instruction, because there's no way to learn everything online.
And this is a first for U of L. It may not be a first in the country, but you have launched your first fully online doctorate degree in social work, right?
That's correct. And again, that's, you know, you raise a really, really interesting point. I think that online, fully online, it's not a question of is it the right thing or the wrong thing, because the answer is always it depends. And the difference is, what level are these students? Where are they coming from? What level of maturity? What are their needs? What do they want to accomplish? So for social work, as you know, there's a desperate need for more clinical training, advanced training. And so this online doctoral work will allow a lot of social workers who are already out in the field to be able to advance their learning and serve society more. And for an undergraduate who's 18 years old, coming onto a college experience, it might not be enough. I'm making broad generalizations here, and I shouldn't. But what I'm trying to say is, I don't think online learning goes away. I think we'll have more hybrid, but hopefully we'll all be more thoughtful about how to integrate it. So, Rick, one thing I will tell you is that the University of Louisville, last year we decided that it wasn't enough just to give financial aid. We gave away over 700 laptops because we knew that the students would need that to do their work. And we continue to plan on that now, too, because there may be aspects of a classroom where professors have realized, hey, I can put my lecture online, and then when students come in, we can have more active discussion. The old flipped classroom model, if you will.
Well, one thing that got disrupted during the pandemic is, of course, residential life, because you switched to mostly online courses. And I know that was a big piece of growth for U of L, was having more students living on campus. Is that something you're seeing, you're optimistic will make a full comeback in the fall?
I do. And actually, this is where I'm so proud of our staff in particular, because as I told you, even during the worst of the pandemic, last spring when all of this started, we never fully shut down our residence life as other universities sometimes did, because so many of our students, we knew that they were safest in our residence halls. They relied on campus housing. So we never fully shut down. We do expect that in the fall, we'll have any magic insight into this, but we do expect the majority of our students, the vast majority of our students, to want to come back to campus. And that's why the more vaccinations there are, the more confident all of us will be about getting them back on campus. So much of campus life is the conversations that happen outside of class, serendipity of running into someone. Those you cannot easily replace. And for the mental health of our students, we're finding isolation, depression, it's really important that we restore some semblance of normalcy to this the best we can.
Well, I drive through campus every morning on my way to work, and one thing I've missed is seeing the students, walking across the street sometimes in front of me when they shouldn't. But that's
indeed.
It's so reassuring to see them out going to class.
Wearing masks, though.
That's right.
I'm so proud of them.
502-814-TALK is the number to call to if you have a question or comment for Dr. Bindapudi, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet, WFPL News is our handle. We had a caller who couldn't stay, had a question. What does U of L do about bad/abusive managers? What is the process to protect staff? What is, I guess generally speaking, what is the process if someone has a problem with their supervisor?
This is a really important question, because one of the things we've said is we want to be a great place to learn. But to be a great place to learn, we must be a great place to work. Our faculty and staff should feel supported, challenged, held accountable, but also everyone is entitled to be in a place where they're treated with respect. That's very, very key. This was one of the areas that was brought to my attention. So we now have an employee success center that Brian Buford is heading up and running for us. And part of the strategy there is coaching and training for all supervisors. So many times, I'll think of an example. Let's see, there may be 10 nurses, and you see.
Did we lose Dr. Bindapudi? Oh, I think she may have gone. Let's see if we can get her back. 502-814-TALK is our number, 502-814-8255. We've been talking to Dr. Neely Bindapudi, the president of the University of Louisville, about what's been going on during the coronavirus pandemic and what lies ahead for the university. U of L will be coming back to all in-person classes in the fall, as will many other public universities and private universities across the state and across the country as vaccinations pick up. She mentioned U of L is going to be operating one of the largest vaccination clinics, the largest vaccination clinic in the state, starting on Monday at Cardinal Stadium, where you can drive through. And now those shots will be available to people 16 and up, as ordered by the governor. That policy is in place now.
I'm sorry, I was able to hear you the whole time. I don't know what happened on my end.
That's okay.
Let me jump right back into my answer.
Sure.
Which is that one of the things we are doing is extensive training for everybody who is in a supervisory position. We just promote people and assume they have the leadership qualities or leadership training. Leadership is also a muscle that needs to be exercised. So we are doing that. We have processes through HR and compliance. I've told people culture is what we tolerate, and we are doing everything we can to make sure we have a positive culture. Hopefully people heard that as part of our strategic plan, we've launched our Employee Success Center, and I'm proud of the work being done there, and I'm very, very hopeful everybody sees the impact that it's having.
I want to ask you about sports real quick, because sports have persevered during all this, really extraordinarily in some cases. But let me ask you, first of all, it's been 4 years now since it was disclosed that the men's basketball program was part of this investigation into a pay-for-play scheme involving Adidas. And, of course, the NCAA launched its investigation. That process is still going on. All that predates you, of course, and the current athletic administration. But where does all that stand now? When do you see it being resolved?
So we requested and were granted the opportunity to go through it's an alternative resolution process. And so we got that permission, and we're waiting to see when they will schedule it. So it could have gone through the traditional NCAA or through this alternative process. So right now we're waiting to hear what happens. And let me assure you, I am as eager as everybody else to get this behind us.
Yeah, these things tend to drag on. But otherwise, on the positive side, it's been a pretty good year for some sports. We had the women's basketball team made the Elite Eight in the NCAA tournament. And I believe the swim team won a national title in one of the competitions, right?
Volleyball's doing well. I mean, I'm just proud, because I wish that all of us held ourselves to the same standards as some of these young people have to say, no matter what is going on, we're going to stay focused, we have discipline, and that the team comes above the individual. And so there's a lot to celebrate, and you're right, athletics so often, as has been said, is like the front porch, the front door to the university. That's something that starts people to look at us, but hopefully once they come in, they see the fullness of everything we need to celebrate.
We are out of time. Dr. Neely Bindapudi, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and my apologies for that technical glitch.
No problem at all. I knew you were coming back.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks to our In Conversation production team for their work today. Michelle Tyrene Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Russell Wells, and Bill Burton. Our theme was composed by Kojin Toshiro. And I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.